Good morning, good day, good evening, good night, no matter what time it is. Justin here again, bringing you another episode of the Knuckle Sandwich Podcast. How do you like that? So on today's episode of the KSP, we're going to talk a little bit about the recent G1 action that just concluded with this morning's show. Some good old A block action coming at ya. Of course, we're going to talk about the B block action from yesterday as well. But before we get into any of that business, we got to give a quick hey, how do you do to J-Bomb and Dez at Talkamania. Of course, this show, the KSP, is part of the Talkamania Network. And if you're looking for WWE action and news and reviews and such, they are definitely the place to be. They just had an episode, actually, that just came out looking forward to SummerSlam based on Raw and SmackDown from this week. Salty Dez did not make a full-on appearance, but I fear that with this whole Becky Lynch and now a triple threat with Charlotte nonsense, I think by the time next week rolls around, I think Salty Dez may be back to max capacity. But anyway, be that as it may, if you want to hear all that goodness, feel free to check that out if you aren't already, because if you're not, why the heck aren't you? Check them out on Talkamania. You can find them on Twitter, too, at _Talkamania. So, on with today's show. And I guess it would be wise to do this stuff in chronological order, so we're going to do that. We're going to start off with Wednesday morning show, which featured B-block action. In the actual block matches, we had Tama Tonga and Tomohiro Ishii, Juice Robinson and Sonata, Tetsuya Naito and Toru Yano, Kenny Omega and Zack Sabre Jr. in what I was hoping to be an upset, and Kota Ibushi and Hirooki Goto. So Tonga actually got a rare win over Tomohiro Ishii, although it did take his brother Tongaloa, Bad Luck Fale, a number of ref bumps, and a motherfucking steel chair to beat Ishii, because that bastard is tough, and they call him what they call him for a reason, which is the Stone Pitbull. And that dude took a beating, but nonetheless, regardless of all the shenanigans, Tama Tonga did come out with the win, which now put both he and Tomohiro Ishii at 4 points. Not a very stellar result so far. Ishii, you can't blame, he's certainly trying. However, with Tonga, he's been DQs aplenty, so I'm even surprised that he's had that many points given the circumstances. Juice Robinson with a win over Sonata, a very hard-fought contest. Juice came out on top, which puts him at 4 points. I honestly did not expect that result. I really thought that Sonata was going to get the win over Juice, and Juice was going to be at a record of 1-5. But thank goodness, this puts him now at 4 points, so a record of 2-4. Still not great, but he's sticking it out there. And Sonata remains at 6 points, which pretty much kind of puts him out of contention at this point. Tetsuya Naito defeated Toru Yano. Naito definitely tried to win by countout when he taped Yano's arm to the guardrail. Yano couldn't free himself, so in order to beat the 20 count, he dragged the guardrail into the ring with him. Definitely a fun piece of business on that one. Shenanigans ensued, as you would think, between Naito and Yano. Eventually, Naito landed the Destino for the win, and that put him up to 10 points. So with that win, not only was he at 10 points, but that put him neck and neck with Kenny Omega, the IWGP Heavyweight Champion, who was also sitting at 10 points, going into, of course, this match with Zack Sabre Jr. Not Jack Sabre Jr., Dez, if you're listening. It's Zack Sabre Jr. You want to talk about Salty Dez? It was definitely Salty J-Ro when I was listening to that episode, and I heard you say Jack Sabre Jr. Anyway, I'm going to let it be. Unfortunately, it was not Zack's day either. I really thought that Zack was going to surprise Kenny with a submission win. And although, it was a really close call and a fun match, Zack had pretty much countered nearly all of Kenny's big offense and avoided it no matter what. He was catching his leg whenever he was trying to go for the big V-trigger knee strike. Anytime he would go for the one-winged angel, Zack would find a counter to it. Until eventually, of all things, I thought he was going to have Omega submitting to his leg lock, the orienteering with napalm death. But somehow Kenny managed to A, get to the ropes finally after a hard battle to get there, and then shortly thereafter he'd surprised Zack with a series of roll-ups and a modified cradle, got him the 1-2-3, and Zack was in disbelief, as was I, and I think a fair enough amount of fans out there. Everybody thought that if the odds were going to happen that Omega was not going to come out of the block undefeated, if anyone, it was probably going to be Zack Sabre Jr., if not Kota Ibushi at the very end. But I really thought that Zack was going to have this one, therefore guaranteeing him a title shot later on down the road, but that was not to be. Omega came out on top, which leads us now, with Omega now at 12 points back in the lead in front of Naito, the main event being that the show was in Kagoshima, Ibushi's hometown. He was in the main event against the never open weight champion Hirooki Goto. Ibushi came out on top in a very hard fought battle, finally landing his big Kamigoye knee strike for the win, which put Ibushi at 8 points, which means that the B block is basically down to Ibushi, Naito, and Omega in that order at 8 points, 10 points, and 12 points apiece. Now, before I get into today's A block action, a buddy and I, we were talking in the morning. I usually text him the results, so when he gets up, they're there for him, and then we have our little text exchange. We were talking, at least I was theorizing, about what could happen for the B block. Now, for those unfamiliar, if you're unfamiliar with the G1, the big thing not only is that the matches are a half hour, wins are 2 points, losses obviously zero, and draws are 1 point, but if, at the end of the block series, if there are two wrestlers that are tied in points, the tiebreaker boils down to who won the match between those two wrestlers. So, given the point circumstance, if Naito were to somehow tie up Omega, you know, if Omega got a loss in the next few, and Naito were to tie him in points, it would not matter because in the first night of B block action, Omega and Naito fought and Omega came out on top. So in order to win the B block, Naito or Ibushi essentially, well, Naito will have to top Omega on points. For Ibushi's sake, he would either have to top Omega on points, which seems very unlikely right now, or the more likely option of tying Omega in points, but getting the win over him in their block match on the very last night of the B block, which seems like that's where the drama is going to lead us to, which kind of leads to the matches that are coming up. So in the B block, they have 3 shows left because A block goes first. So A block's got 2, and B block's got 3. So the way it's working out right now is that Ibushi, in his case, he has Tama Tonga to deal with, and Naito and Omega. As a matter of fact, the next show is Ibushi and Naito. Then he has Tama Tonga. That one's a bit tricky. In all fairness, given how things have been going, Tama Tonga will likely end up getting disqualified. However, Tonga was also able to get wins over guys like Ishii. So it all really boils down to, is Tonga going to get disqualified, or is Tonga going to cheat his way to a victory? That's where it's going to be the big question mark, and that's really where it's going to position where Ibushi is going to end up. As far as Naito goes, he has, obviously, after Ibushi on the next show, he has his stablemate Sonata to deal with, and then he has Zack Sabre Jr. on the last night. So again, those matches may dictate where Naito ends up. And as far as Kenny's concerned, I believe he has, I know he's got Toru Yano. Obviously, he's got Ibushi on the last night, and I believe his next one is against Tomohiro Ishii, which is probably going to be no small feat in and of itself. Ishii has beaten Omega before, Omega has beaten Ishii before, and you know, Ishii's only got 4 points. He knows he's not going to win this tournament, but if he gets a win over Omega, that will give him a heavyweight title match at some point in the future. So all these matches are still very important. And it's funny because earlier in the week, I think at the start of the week or on the previous weekend, I almost thought it might have been a done deal. But That's the beauty of these block matches. Sometimes it really boils down to the very end. So we're going to see where that goes. It's very likely, at least if I had to make my prediction, I would probably say that Omega will, at the very least, win one of the next two, not counting Ibushi. So either Ishii or Yano. I guess it would be fair if Omega was going to lose a match, it would make more sense booking-wise for the future to have Ishii get the win, because that's a big win for Ishii. So at that point, sure, he'll only end up with 6 points, but he's got a heavyweight title match. If Toru Yano manages to sneak a win over Omega, I think it won't have the same kind of effect, because I don't think a Yano victory will be legitimate. You know he's going to cheat his way to a win, right? It's just shenanigans with a guy like Toru Yano. So I think if anything, if someone was going to beat Omega before we get to the last night, Ishii will be that guy. Omega will then get a win over Yano, which will put him at 14 points. Then it boils down to Naito and Ibushi. And in all fairness to Ibushi, I think Naito is going to win that match, and he's going to win his match over Sonata, which will also put him at 14 points, which then boils down to the very last night. Naito will have to get a win over Zack Sabre Jr., and not only will he have to get a win over Zack Sabre Jr., at that point, he's going to have to become Kota Ibushi's number one fan, because he will need Ibushi to either not only beat Kenny Omega or hold him to a draw, which will only get Omega 1 point and not enough to catch up to what Naito will then have after a victory over ZSJ, which is 16 points. But again, that is just speculation on my part. It could go a number of different ways, and goodness knows it has before. As a matter of fact, before I even get into the A block thing, and I will, someone was kind enough, Andrew was kind enough to point out to me on Twitter. He hit up myself and he hit up my Talkmania cohorts of the DM, and he said, by the way, you actually, I don't know if you do fact checking, and I don't. I usually don't. Usually when I start recording these, a lot of times you'll hear me say, I think that's what it was, or this is what I think I remember, and I usually add, although I could be wrong, don't hold me to it. That is me saving myself from any fact-checking. But Andrew took care of the fact-checking for me, so I want to thank him for that. So Andrew had pointed out that in the year 2000, the champion did win the G1 Climax, as I figured. However, I believed it was Masahiro Chono because he's known as Mr. G1. I was wrong. It was actually Kensuke Sasaki, who was IWGP Heavyweight Champion and who won the G1 Climax in the year 2000. Now, as far as my other point about Kenny Omega being the first to be undefeated, he wasn't the first to be undefeated. However, there's a bit of a caveat to it, and I'll establish that. In 2009, Shinsuke Nakamura went undefeated in his B block in the G1. However, there's two big things to point out here. Number one, the field in the G1 Climax that year was only 14 and not 20. Therefore, instead of Omega, who has 9 matches in block competition, because there's a field of 20, and he can't wrestle himself, this isn't Mortal Kombat, Nakamura only had 6 matches. So he went 6-0. Now, here's where it gets kind of funny and kind of relates to the point about why I wanted to bring this up and how the G1 Climax can go in any particular direction. He went undefeated in the B block. He did not win the G1 Climax. The A block ended up with 2 guys tied at 7 points, I believe. Again, I believe. I'm not double-checking it, but that was Hiroshi Tanahashi and Togi Makabe. And they ended up at 7 points, and ironically enough, when they wrestled each other, neither man got the win over the other, so he went to a draw. So they literally had no normal tiebreaker circumstance. You would think, well, maybe they'll fight each other again and see who wins. No, it went to a coin flip. Yeah, a fucking coin flip to determine who won the block. Makabe won the block and then defeated Nakamura in the final to win the G1 Climax that year. Imagine that. Nakamura with a record of 6-0, Makabe with a record of 3-1-2, and Makabu gets through on a fucking coin flip. Or 3-2-1, depending on which. 3 wins, 1 draw, 2 losses. Hopefully you follow me. And Makabe gets in off a coin flip and then defeats Nakamura in the finals. Just like, what? What the hell? So, again, although Omega, there's a very real possibility Omega may go undefeated in the block, which would be the first time that the heavyweight champion, I believe, has gone undefeated. Although, Andrew, if you're out there and I'm wrong, you may point it out to me, and I could always Google it, but I'm not gonna. I'm doing this. I'm sitting down and I'm talking to you. He would be the first champion, certainly, to go undefeated in the 20-man era, let's call it. I mean, goodness knows it might be a few more years and they might up it to 22 or 24, but right now it's 20, which is a pretty good number, and it has been that for a few years now, and he'd be the first champion to go undefeated. But ironically enough, he could still lose in the final to whomever comes out on top of the A block. Because that's the beauty of the G1. And speaking of the A block, that's what we're going to jump into right now. Because the A block had their show today, and they have 2 shows remaining. So based on today's show, here's what went down real quickly. So first we had Bad Luck Fale and He Who Must Not Be Named, a.k.a. Michael Elgin. We had Hangman Adam Page and Togi Makabe. Switchblade Jay White and Yoshihashi. Hiroshi Tanahashi, the ace, against the King of Darkness, Evil, and the Rainmaker, Kazuchika Okada, or possibly Balloon Maker at this point, for anybody watching the shows. Kazuchika Okada against one of my personal favorites, the most vicious man to ever grace a New Japan ring, Minoru Suzuki. So starting off the top, Elgin was victorious over Fale by disqualification due to interference from Tama Tonga and Tangaloa. They continued, however, as if that wasn't enough, they assaulted Elgin's injured arm with a chair. So not only do the Tongans not give a flying F about getting points in this G1, they basically want to ruin it for everybody, so much so that they may cause Elgin to lose his last couple of matches due to the assault with the chair on his injured arm. Fun. Hangman Adam Page. Man, that guy needed a win, and he got a win over Togi Makabe. A big win for him. He fought back from Makabe's best stuff, Spider German, all that good stuff, and he managed to land his over-the-back tombstone pile driver, and the name escapes me, I'm sorry, to get the win over Togi Makabe against basically a notable mainstay staple heavyweight of New Japan Pro Wrestling. That is a big win for Hangman Adam Page. I believe that only puts him at 4 points now, but still, we'll take it. It's a step in the right direction, and that's how these things usually go, and I see more bright things for Adam Page. Switchblade, Jay White, continues to be his asshole prickish self as he picked up a win over his stablemate, Yoshihashi, and he keeps playing this whole supposed leadership, that he wants to gain leadership of Chaos and change the faction as he sees fit. So that continued, just being a complete asshole. But of course he got the win, which gives him 2 more points, now putting him at 10, which tied Tanahashi for the lead. Speaking of Tanahashi, he came out on top over Evil in a big back and forth match, which is kind of what you'd expect with guys like Tanahashi and Evil. You know you're going to get a good one. With the high fly flow, Tanahashi got the win, which brought him back in front now with 12 points. However, with the loss, that means that Evil is now mathematically eliminated from contention as he only has 6 points. So now we get down to the other 2 guys, particularly aside from Jay White, who could stand a shot because they are both sitting at 8. And I'm talking about Kazuchika Okada and Minoru Suzuki. This one was quick. Suzuki didn't even let Okada get into the ring. He jumped him immediately, threw him to the outside, and, excuse the pun, chaos ensued. Suzuki was throwing Okada all over the building, hitting with everything that was not nailed down while the ref was trying to get some kind of composure over the whole situation, which obviously, as you can imagine with Minoru Suzuki, it ain't gonna happen. You let Suzuki do what Suzuki wants to do, and he'll let you know when he's fucking done. That's basically how that worked. Okada almost got counted out not once but twice just due to Suzuki bludgeoning him with a chair or whatever he had on hand, and then basically just leaving him for dead and making his way back to the ring. Both times, Okada just got in at the count of 19 to save himself from being counted out. If that wasn't enough, Suzuki started jumping onto Okada and going after that arm, particularly the Rainmaker arm, to render that effect ineffective. Very Pokemon-ish. Okada then mounted a comeback, and he started throwing elbows after elbows. They basically started elbowing the ever-loving piss out of each other while Suzuki was laughing the whole time, which shows just how much I love that guy. They went to some finisher attempts. Suzuki went with it, got an octopus stretch. Okada escapes it into a tombstone. Okada then recovers and tries for, He tries for Suzuki's own sleeper into the Gotch-style pile driver. Suzuki avoids it, goes for Okada's tombstone. Okada flips him back over, tries for the tombstone. He realizes Suzuki's fighting him too much, so he actually hooks it up Gotch-style and tombstones him with a Gotch-style tombstone. Follow that with not one but two Rainmakers, and Okada gets the 1-2-3 over Suzuki, which means that Okada now ties Jay White at 10 points, and Suzuki only being at 8 points with only two shows left, it's impossible for him to catch up at this point. He is out. So, very interesting. So much like the B block, where you've got a 12, a 10, and an 8, in this case, in the A block, you've got a 12 and two 10s. Tanahashi leads, but White and Okada are just close behind. Now, what makes this interesting, obviously Jay White's got some matches that he's going to have to deal with, but the big one right now is the last night of the A block, which will be on next Friday. Tanahashi against Okada. So if Okada gets that win, he will likely be, because it's not guaranteed, but he will likely be tied for points with Tanahashi, which means that Okada would get the go-ahead because he gets the win. However, the big thing that needs to be remembered here is Jay White is just behind at 10 points, but all he needs to do is tie the leader because he's already beaten both of these guys, Tanahashi and Okada. All White needs to do is tie for points, and he wins the block. Pure and simple. And then we could be looking at a Switchblade Jay White, Kenny Omega final. My God, that would be something else. I shudder to think, because that would be a rematch of their U.S. title match when White won the title from Omega when he surprised him with the Blade Runner. So could it be? That'd be a big thing, especially for Jay White to pull off, not only to beat Omega again, but to beat him while he's heavyweight champion, to beat him in the finals of the G1, therefore securing his title shot against Omega at Wrestle Kingdom. Now, the greater judgment wants me to believe that Okada's going to find a way to come out on top, which will lead to Omega Okada 5 at Wrestle Kingdom. I mean, I just don't know, though. I feel like this Omega Okada, what they did at Dominion with that 2 out of 3 falls with a no time limit that went to 65 minutes, like, I don't think it's necessary to write another chapter in that feud, at least not so soon. And it's funny that I'm saying not so soon, because their match was in June and this next one would be in January, but it still feels soon, you know, by New Japan booking standards, right? But if you look at what they've done, title match 1, Okada came out on top, and that was like 45 minutes or something. Title match 2 was last June. Oh, no, sorry. Or was it the June before that? Oh, my God, I don't remember. Yeah, I think it was the June before that. And, yes, it was. And that went to a time limit draw, 60 minutes. First time that's happened in a long, long time. Then they ended up in the same block together in the G1 that summer, not that far behind, and Omega finally got his win over Okada, which led to, and here's the funny thing is, Okada was champion while this happened, so you would think that Omega would have got another title shot between then and Wrestle Kingdom of that year, because Naito got his title shot, but he didn't get another title shot. I think it's just because they wrestled each other so much, it just never bothered to happen. That and Omega became the first United States champion, so he was busy with that title. You can't really challenge for another one while you hold one. New Japan's big on that. Or at least for the most part. So now you get this whole oh, now we might do Okada again. Well, for one, you might have, well, no, yeah, you might have Okada and Omega in the final, or you might have Okada and Naito in the final. I'm jumping the gun here on this. It's possible. We could have Okada and Ibushi. That would be a big one. There's a real combination. The funny thing is, the one person that I seem to be leaving out of the conversation is Tanahashi. And I don't know why I'm leaving him out of... Actually, you know what? I think I do know why I'm leaving him out of the conversation. Tanahashi, yes, being the ace of New Japan for so long. But we all know, at least most of us know, that he's kind of moving on to that... Not quite part-timer, because he's still going full tilt, but he's moving to that next stage of his career. I don't know if it might be past that point. I just don't see a real benefit in Tanahashi winning the G1. I don't even know if I see a benefit in Tanahashi winning the A block, pure and simple. I mean, he might, who knows, but I don't see a real benefit to Tanahashi winning the G1 and getting a title shot at Wrestle Kingdom. I think that moment's passed. I think we need to move on. I don't think Tanahashi needs another big run in the sun. I mean, he had a great title match with Okada, the last one that they had, but I think that was to close that chapter too. The Okada, well, for the most part, the Okada Tanahashi chapter. Although we're about to write another one in the G1, so who knows? I don't know. I feel like Tanahashi, in my eyes, is the John Cena of New Japan. And I know that's probably going to irk people the wrong way, and I'm sorry. It's just the way that I see it. He's been at the top for so long, and he's had all the big main events that you can pretty much dream of having. He's had all the big title runs. He had the record, I think, V11 was the record he had, 11 title defenses before Okada managed to beat him and have 12 title defenses, which is huge, by the way. So I think, like, I don't think there's anything else he needs to accomplish aside from helping the other guys get their shots in the limelight by having matches with him. And I don't think that it's necessary for Tanahashi to win the G1 and have a Wrestle Kingdom match for that reason. It's just my opinion. They might go another way. It is New Japan. Anything's possible. And the funny thing is, with New Japan, whether I'm overly pleased or displeased with the result itself, the actual content therein, the matches and how things work out are always entertaining, and I'm never disappointed. So we'll just have to see how it plays out. So that was the G1 in a not so nutshell over the past couple of days. And things are going to get very interesting as we go into this last week and a half. Next show is Saturday morning. That is the next B block show. Then there's two shows left for each block. A block on Sunday morning at the lovely hour of 2 a.m. which I am, or 2 a.m. or is it 4 a.m.? I think it might be, 4 a.m. is Saturday and 2 a.m. is Sunday. Not a fan of that one. And then there's the show in Yokohama on Wednesday. And then finally back to the Budokan, the motherfucking Budokan. They're not doing the Ryogoku Kukui-kan. They're doing the Budokan for the A block final on Friday, the B block final on Saturday, and then the motherfucking G1 final on Sunday, which will also be at 2 a.m. So if I sound sleep deprived in the upcoming episodes after, you know, it's all said and done, you will know why. And you know why right now, because I'm telling you, because I will be sleep deprived from staying up and watching the G1. But then it'll be done and we can move on with our lives and I can try to reestablish some kind of sleep schedule, which is a blatant lie because I work nights. So whatever. I'm lying to myself. I'm trying to humor myself. You with me? You gonna leave it be? Is that good? All right, great. Let's move on, shall we? So, kudos to my Talkmania cohorts for breaking this news before I could. But the King of Bros, Matt Riddle, it is confirmed he has signed a deal with the WWE. He'll be headed there. And if anything, I think Dez was right on the head. I think they're going to do the same thing they usually do with the big signees when they bring him in. They don't do anything with them until the next takeover where they're shown in the crowd. And I think knowing the New York crowd, I think they're going to explode for seeing Matt Riddle there at TakeOver. I think that's going to be great. Now, I guess this is kind of a way to help my cohorts out because they're a little unfamiliar with Matt Riddle's work. So yes, Matt Riddle was originally a mixed martial artist. He fought in the UFC. He had 6 consecutive wins in the welterweight division, I believe. And then in 2013, he didn't leave. He was fired. The belief is it had to do with the fact that Mr. Riddle likes the wacky tobacco. And I believe I've seen a few interviews around that time where people asked Dana White about it. And Dana White, I believe, went on record and said that Matt Riddle was a fucking idiot. Again, his opinion. His loss is pro wrestling's gain, the way I see it. Because shortly thereafter, he went to, I think, a tryout with WWE or got in touch with them or something. And WWE then kind of put him in touch with Gabe Sapolsky, former Ring of Honor booker. And owner slash booker of Evolve Wrestling, and said, "Hey, I have this guy, Matt Riddle. He's got a great MMA background. He's thinking of getting into wrestling. Can you help him out? Can you kind of get him started?" They said, "Absolutely." And they, instead of like pussyfooting around, they're like, "All right, we're going to put you with some of the best guys we have. And you're just going to see if you can hang trial by fire." And trial by fire, hang he did. That made no sense, but whatever. Hang, he did. He managed to get in there, and obviously, fast forward a number of years, Riddle has worked pretty much all over the globe. He's had big mainstays, not only in Evolve, where he is the champion after defeating Zack Sabre Jr., but he is also WWN champion, and he's been a champion just about everywhere. Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. I mean, he's worked for just about every organization that you can think of, other than Ring of Honor, a big Japanese organization like New Japan, Impact Wrestling, or the WWE. He's worked just about everywhere else. As far as like most places that you would think of. I don't know if he had any time in Mexico. I highly doubt it. He doesn't really seem like the type that would blend in with Lucha. But what he does give is a very, very stiff, very physical style. He's a great grappler, great striker. His kicks and his knees are unbelievable. His suplexes, namely the side gut wrench that he does, is out of this world. He's great. And he's good with his submissions too. So he brings that offense to the table. And yes, although he does wrestle bare feet, that's led to a number of things. I mean, it's part of that MMA style, right? They fight bare feet. So it's something that Riddle brings to the table, not wearing wrestling shoes or boots or anything. It's one of those other things that makes him stand out. Plus, he got bro over. It's over everywhere. You can't see a match with Riddle coming out and the people aren't chanting bro, bro, bro. Like, it's amazing. That's why he's the king of bros. Now, I hope that this whole, I think I talked about this in the previous episode, this whole weed thing, I hope it doesn't lead to any issues with him, because obviously if you ask Evan Bourne, that didn't work out so well for him. Matt Sydal, of course, for those unfamiliar with his WWE name. But I do hope all the best for Riddle. I think he could be that type of authentic talent that brings something completely different to the table, and I think it'll give him the opportunity to stand out. Obviously, they would be wise to start him out in NXT, but I don't think it'll be long before he's kind of making a really big name for himself, and I hope the popularity of Matt Riddle catches on to the NXT faithful, just as it has warmed the hearts and broed the bros of the independent world. Anyway, all the best to him. I can't wait to see him on my TV. I look forward to it very soon. Hey, here's a fun one. I think I'm gonna drop a piece of news. It might be news, it might be complete bullshit. I actually kinda hope it's the latter and not the former, but I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit bitter about the guys dropping the whole Matt Riddle thing before I had the opportunity to do so. They're trudging in on my independent news. So I'm gonna reciprocate with this little fun piece of information that some of you may have seen circulating about Twitter. So I'm gonna read it as it is, and then we will take it in, we will stop, we will breathe, and we will make of it what we will. Are you ready? Perfect. Here we go. Okay, so here it is, and I quote. So when you hear me, it's not me, it's whomever reported this nonsense. So here you go. Multiple sources high up in WWE have confided in me some very serious and damning information. It would appear Kevin Dunn, old Buckteeth himself, sorry, side note, is leading a small task force in the WWE at the personal order of Vince McMahon to pay fans to support Roman Reigns both at television tapings and on social media. Focus groups are showing an alarming few number of WWE fans like Reigns, so WWE is paying large sums of money to make sure that isn't the case. The amounts have not been confirmed, but I've been told anywhere from $100 to $200 per fan at live events to throw away their anti-Roman signs and replace them with pro-Roman signs, depending on seating. On social media, fans are being paid anywhere from $1 to $10 per tweet, $5 to $20 per Instagram post, and $1 to $3 per Facebook comment in support of Reigns. These numbers vary depending on influence and reach. It has been noted that Kevin Dunn and Vince McMahon are both petrified at the animosity, disdain, and growing indifference towards Reigns and are doing everything they can to shift the narrative in their favor. This task force has been in place since January of 2017, but is only coming to light now as WWE employees are fed up and think this needs to be exposed at all costs. It is estimated that this task force has spent $5.8 million so far on fan payouts, with no real ceiling to the budget. Fans are signing very powerful NDAs, that's non-disclosure agreements for those not familiar with legalese, very powerful NDAs that would result in excessive fines if violated, which means this story will be denied up and down now that it's been broken. However, if enough fans make a big enough stink about it, this could have massive implications, so let WWE hear your voice with the hashtag StopRomanPayouts at all costs and hashtag NeverRoman. Okay, I'm surprised I got through that without laughing. I think it's a whole bunch of malarkey. I think it's a whole bunch of hogwash, and in blatant terms, a little bit more coarse terms, I think it's fucking bullshit. I don't see why WWE would go. Let's assume, as Hung Lu Kim on South Park would say, when the Mongolians knock down his wall, I'll pray wrong. Let's assume that we live in a world where WWE was now willing to engage in what I like to consider paid patriotism, to kind of pay people to get behind Roman Reigns. First of all, they're paying the man, what, at least $2 million a year on his salary? Probably more. I don't really know the numbers. Again, I'm just spitballing. Don't come to me for fact-checking. I'm just, you know, it is what it is. They're paying him millions of dollars a year. They're now going to spend an additional, let's just round it up and say $6 million. They said 5.8, but let's just say 6, because more shows keep taking place, and I guess everybody's getting paid off. Where the fuck's my check? To continue to engage in this behavior, right? So they're going to spend an additional $6 million over and above the $2 million they're already paying him. With the belief that he should be getting over on his own, right? I kind of need J-Bomb to help me out with some Coldplay on this one, but, you know. Why would they now spend 300% above what they're paying him to get people, just people, to then say, oh, Roman's the best. Now, where's my check, please? Like, I don't understand the fucking logic. First of all, they are a business. WWE is a business, and believe you me, we have seen it before. When someone is not producing results and they're basically being overpaid to do a certain thing and you know, it's kind of catching wind, out the fucking door you go. All right? Brock Lesnar's been paid, I don't know how much, what, $5 million or something ridiculous like that. And now they're actually forcing the narrative where people are there to hate him. Now, mind you, he's more the exception to the rule because he's a part-timer in every sense of the word, and he's also, you know, carrying their fruit roll-up title. So maybe that's a bad example. But what I'm trying to say is they are a business. If the person that's being paid one of the highest salaries in the company is not producing the results that they should be, then I'm sorry. It's time to move on to the next person. Certainly, if you're paying them less, there's certainly no harm in moving to that person because you're getting better results for lesser expenses until you eventually, you know, it's time to renew their contract, renegotiate, and then you got to pay them the good money, right? I.e. Daniel Bryan, i.e. a number of other guys. So I just don't see the logic. I don't see the logic. And I don't understand why they would go to such a degree in doing this for such a long period of time and then keep it, you know, super secret with NDAs and how we're only finding out about this now. Like, if this happened, if this really happened since, what did they say, January of 2017, I think it said, we live in the age of the internet, people. This would have made its way out a lot friggin' sooner than now. I'm sorry, but we live in a world where people, regardless of whether they signed NDAs or whatnot, they have the inability to shut the fuck up. It's like when you meet someone and they're vegan and they're like, you know, they're holding their breath till they can tell you that they're vegan. I know it's a bad example, and I'm sorry if I'm offending someone. It's the first thing that jumped in my head, you know? It's like, people have the inability to shut the fuck up about things like this. I don't see how this could really be a legitimate story. Now, if it is, oh my God, first of all, I'm not even mad about it. It's hilarious that they're going to fork out X amount more millions of dollars to essentially accomplish what I find is fucking nothing. Because the amount of booze that the guy still gets, it makes you wonder, okay, did they get paid and they're just like, well, we got our money now. What are they going to do? Take it back from us? Let's boom anyway. They can't watch all of us and see how we're all reacting. I guess the key is look for the guys with the pro-Roman signs that are still booing Roman when he's out. I guess that's the only Where's Waldo type evidence I can give you. I'm sorry. I can't give you anything more than that. That's why I just don't find it to be legitimate. I just don't see it. I'm sorry. But it's damn hilarious. And whomever crafted that concoction, first of all, I'm going to give him props on the wording. I think that was good. It was well written. I don't quite know whether they are American or if they're Canadian because of how certain words were spelt. Some of them were spelled the O way. Some of them were spelled the OU way. It's kind of mix and match both. So they're kind of throwing me off the scent a little bit. Who knows? I think it's interesting. I think it's hilarious, and I felt the need to share with it, mostly just out of sheer bitterness over the Matt Riddle story. So take that for what it's worth. Hiya! Although I do have a happier story that I want to share with you. The word has made its way around, and if you are a Canadian fan like myself, you've already heard the news, so I'm just kind of reiterating. This is more so to my other people listening out there that are outside the circle or further away and have other people to root for. But I think it's fantastic. The announcement was made yesterday that the Mountain herself, the 6'2" Vanessa Craven, the most dangerous set of pigtails walking God's green earth, or, you know, science's green earth, whatever. she has been selected as to be an entrant in the May. I'm so excited I couldn't get the words out. She will be taking part in this year's May Young Classic. There, I said it. I got it out. And I think it's fantastic news. And obviously, as they plugged her entry into the tournament, they were quick to mention, hey, Vanessa's worked in a lot of places, you know, Montreal and Ottawa, and she's worked for the IWS, where Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn are from. Like, it's all that kind of stuff. So they were quick to kind of point that out and be like, hey, they kind of made it and they were from that circle. And so she might be one to look out for. I think it's awesome news. I think it's a great thing. I'm actually kind of surprised that she was not in the first Mae Young Classic, but I understand. Good things come to those who wait, and goodness knows it's not like she sat around waiting. She's been busting her ass ever since, and I really hope that this brings a lot of good things for Vanessa Craven. So props to you, Vanessa. I will be rooting for you, Mademoiselle. And with that, I think I've dribbled on enough. I think it's been a good show, and I think it's about time we pull the plug on this bad boy. So first of all, thank you for tuning in. I always appreciate it. If you would like to banter with me on the socials, you definitely can. Twitter is the place to do that. Of course, I've got my original account that most of you are familiar with, at Justin S. Roberge, but I'm trying to phase out the grap talk, trying to phase it out, switch it over to my new account specifically for the show, at Nucksand Pod, short for Knuckles Sandwich Podcast. So that's KNUCKSANDPOD. Nucksand Pod, Knuckles Sandwich Podcast. At me all day. I don't mind. You can DM me. I'm very slide-inable. Anything you want to shoot about, any questions you have, any feedback on the show, even if it's just like, hey man, I thought that fucking news story was bullshit too. I agree. Absolutely. Hit me up. Don't be shy. I enjoy the banter. And thank you again, actually, to Andrew for hitting me up with that G1 fact check. I always appreciate a good fact check. A good wrestling fact check is fine with me. Like, a real life fact check, I have some issues, especially if it's current event stuff. Depending on where it comes from, you know, I'll get someone to be like, hey, did you check this out? And it's like from fucking Breitbart or something. It's like, nope, sorry. In the trash it goes. I'm not even touching it with a Kleenex. I don't even want to get dirty. But wrestling fact checks are good all day long. Don't be shy. And of course, props to the guys at Talkmania, who are doing the main show multiple times a week. Obviously, the recent episode just came out, Slummer Slam, which will probably be fixed by then, where they talk about a lot of the stuff, including the Matt Riddle news. Thanks, Dez. And Jack Sabre Jr. I'm not bitter. What are you talking about? You can tune into them multiple times a week. And of course, while you're at it, you can also at them for just about anything wrestling related, especially WWE related. If you ask them about indie stuff, it may be hit or miss. I'm your indie guy. But WWE stuff, Raw, SmackDown, all day long, no doubt. Hit them up at _Talkmania. And more importantly, if you want to look cool, yeah, it's summer. You want to look cool? You want to wear what all the cool kids are wearing? Well, you get your ass over to ProWrestlingTees.com/Talkmania. And I'm telling you, those retro design shirts that we got going on, I got a purple one. It's fucking dope. I got a bunch of friends that have ordered blue ones and they got them. They're fucking dope. The black on white, the white on black. No, not violence. It's a shirt. It's a design and it's cool. It looks like splattered paint and all kinds of cool shit. I don't know anybody that's bought the original design yet, which is kind of funny. The original design is still a nice shirt in its own right, but ever since we came up with the retro design, oh my god, whoever designed that is a genius. I love the purple, I love the blue, I want to see people getting more colors, so we have more colors to ogle, and whatever the word is, foam at the mouth, get horny, that kind of stuff. It's a cool shirt, and you should buy one, ProWrestlingTees.com/Talkmania. Until next time, it has been an absolute pleasure to chat at you, and don't be afraid to at me on the Twitters. I will see you next time. Unos dos, adios amigos, catch you on the flip side.